This is Whitley Strieber. At the edge of reality, there lies an unknown country, a realm of mysteries and truths and the unexpected. If you do not wish to travel in this country, stop listening now. But if you hunger for high adventure and information that others dare not tell you, then welcome to Dreamland. Welcome to the edge of the world. Today we have a guest back with us who some of you may remember from 2009 and again in 2013. Jason Offutt is with us with a new book, Chasing American Monsters. I have to admit, I've had a lot of fun with it. And back in 2009, Jason really wowed us with a story about shadow people and could they be actual real phenomenon. We're going to ask him about that. Then we had a Dreamland show in July of 2013. What lurks beyond the paranormal in your backyard? And then we went on to talk further to Jason about the reality of some of these phenomena. Are they imaginary or not? And his new book gets into monsters and stories of monsters from all over the United States. And some of them are really, really very compelling. And we're going to talk about those. But before we do that, Jason, let's go way back to 2009 and the shadow people. Now, why don't you tell us a little bit about what that whole phenomenon was?
Well, Willie, first, thanks for having me back on. It's always a pleasure to be on the air with you. Shadow people. Yes, I've been fascinated by shadow people since I was fairly young because I encountered shadow people. I was about 8 or 9 years old in my house, and that's in my head. That's what I called them, shadow people, because that's what they looked like. And I hadn't heard anyone else ever experiencing shadow people until Art Bell started talking about them and calling them shadow people in the 1990s. And at that point, I realized I can talk about them now because it wasn't just me. It was other people. And I started researching the phenomenon. I ended up interviewing about 250 people who've experienced these shadow beings literally all around the world.
Well, that's what did you see when you were a kid?
Well, in the book, I categorized them just on their behavior, and what I saw, I categorized as benign shadows because they tended to be they didn't take any notice of me. They seemed to be walking from point A to point B, and my bedroom was just in the middle. I didn't see them anyplace else in my house. But what I saw was, I remember specifically the first night I had just gotten into bed and I hadn't even laid back down yet. I just flipped the light off, and I grew up on a farm. So way out in the country, we had our blinds open all the time because the only peeping toms would be owls. So it was generally gray in the room. When the moon was out, I could see everything. I could see the end of the bed, my bookshelf, the closet door, which was closed. Got to always be closed. And I could see the Farrah Fawcett poster on my wall. So that tips you off as to what era this was in. But one corner of my bedroom was really dark. And all of a sudden, what I took to be a man, stepped out of it and walked past my bed and into the hallway. And it was large, but then again, I was about 8 and I was sitting down in bed, but it was large. It seemed to be two dimensional, like a poorly drawn cartoon. And I couldn't see any features whatsoever because it was black. It looked like a fridge magnet, black and a human cutout, and it walked kind of jerkily past my bed and disappeared. And I saw that same thing happen, over and over again, not every night, but for the next 3 or 4 months, just something, a man-shaped shadow walking through the wall, past my bed and into the hallway and disappearing.
How extraordinary. And you just accepted. How old were you?
Yeah, I was about eight or nine years old.
8 or 9 years old. And did you say anything about this to your parents?
Oh, of course I did. The first probably 5 nights I saw this, I yelled for my father, who said a curse word, got out of bed, walked through the hallway, and turned all the lights on and said, you know, Jason, there's nothing here. And I specifically remember every time I called him, I felt guilty because he was walking toward my bedroom into the, you know, through the same hallway that this thing had just gone into. But he never saw anything, and nobody else in my family did either.
And so you've just concluded that they were just sort of passing through.
Yes, I mean, because that's exactly what they looked like. They were walking with some kind of purpose. And I've always been fairly scientifically minded, even when I was a child. And we had a rural blacktop road that went in front of the house. And I initially thought, well, maybe it's shadows or something from headlights, but there never were cars going by at the same time when I saw these.
Yeah, so you had an experience, but then you're listening to Art, and lo and behold, he starts talking about it. How did that make you feel?
Well, it made me, you know, I was a little stunned at first because I've heard people talk about, you know, seeing ghosts and you know, other entities, but nothing as specific as what I saw. And all of a sudden, Art is talking about not just describing what I saw, but calling them what I personally called them, which was shadow people. And all of the calls that he got in, I felt pretty relieved on one end because I wasn't alone. I hadn't just seen them. I wasn't nuts. And on the other end, it made me a little bit worried because, you know, if I saw them and other people have seen them, they really probably were real. So I had something unknown walking through my room when I was a child. So that's a little unnerving.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now in 2013, we began to talk about something very interesting. I'll read to you from the blurb about the show we did in July of 2013. Jason Offutt is back with a chilling discovery. The paranormal is getting stronger, and it is spreading. Listen to the chilling reasons that Jason knows this. Now it's 2019, and listen, you were right. You were right, at least as far as I'm concerned. In my experience of life, you were right.
Yeah, right. And well, back then, the book that I'd put together was, I noticed there were a lot of paranormal occurrences that were within a 100-mile radius of my house. So I covered them. And the more I dug into it, the more I realized that the paranormal activity is happening everywhere. And it seemed to be, you know, happening a lot more often than it did in the past. And yes, that growth has continued. It could be a couple of things. I mean, one, that, you know, that it is continuing, that we're having more monster sightings, more encounters with extraterrestrials, with the visitors, with, you know, people, you know, time slipping from the past or the future into our time. Or it could simply be the fact that our communication today is so widespread and instantaneous. And maybe we're just talking about it more. Maybe the world's always been this polluted with unknown phenomena, and now we're just now getting around to realizing that.
You know, in 2013, I hadn't seen the visitors in years. Now, in 2019, the last time I had a contact with them was Sunday night. And I'm writing a book that's virtually being written with them. And I still don't know what they are. I have no idea. And yet they're here. They're here all the time now in this house. They wake me, if I don't meditate with them at 3 o'clock in the morning, they will wake me up to do it every time. Now, to me, that's much more paranormal activity than I knew at any time in my whole past life. Even during the communion experience, even during those years of 85, 86, and 87, it wasn't nearly this intense. So I think it is expanding. I think you were right in that book.
It could be, and here's something else I've noticed, and I don't like to get into religious talk, not in my books or during interviews, but But with the paranormal increasing, growing up, my parents, you know, of course, got myself and my sisters in the car every Sunday morning and went to church. And I don't remember ever once remember the pastor talking about demons or the Nephilim or anything else that was negative in the Bible. You know, Satan didn't come up. But recently, talking with a lot of different people, that this is a topic that goes on, you know, not just in you know, a Catholic or Lutheran church, but in your in Methodist and Baptist churches as well. So, you know, maybe we're all, you know, getting in tune with the fact that that this things are building right now, and we probably should be prepared for them.
Free Dreamlanders, I've got some good news and some bad news. The bad news is, well, never mind the bad news. The good news is, listen up.
Whitley Strieber has published an incredible 2-volume historical novel called In Hitler's House under his open pseudonym Jonathan Lane. This amazing story follows the life of William Weber, who meets Hitler while touring Germany in 1931 and becomes his friend and confidant. But then, when he realizes the truth, becomes a spy in Hitler's house for the Allies. Living a life of terrible danger, he falls in love with another of Hitler's secret friends, also a spy in his house. This is a story of espionage and desperate love, and the deepest portrait of Adolf Hitler ever created. Don't miss In Hitler's House, available in paperback and as an ebook on Amazon.
Aloha, Jeremy Vaney here, and I want to tell you about my latest undertaking, OurUndoing.com. OurUndoing.com is a multimedia website where if you watch, if you read, if you listen, without trying to absorb knowledge like we do with normal learning, and without the normal judgmental filters that we use to compare and contrast so-called spiritual knowledge, if we watch, if we read, if we listen without all of that, we may just wake up to our full human nature. That is what this website is for. It's not about what we're doing, it's about who we are, truly are, when we're off the pendulum of duality. If your life is about seeking truth above all else, look no further. Join me at OurUndoing.com.
We're talking to Jason Offit, his very cool new book, Chasing American Monsters. His website, Jason Offit, that's with two T's, OFFUTT.com. JasonOffit.com. He's written some other very, very interesting books. If you haven't read them, definitely pick them up. They are really worth reading. They're lots of fun. Jason is not a heavy duty writer, I wouldn't say. I wouldn't call you heavy duty.
I wouldn't either. I think my writing is, you know, I like to have fun while I'm writing, and I like people to have fun while they're reading. So I tried not to get too heavy-handed.
Well, I certainly have had fun with all three of your books, and I really must say there are some things in Chasing American Monsters that were kind of unexpected to me. And in fact, later on in the show, I'm going to talk about one of them. You have a monster in there that I have got a video of. That is one of the premier unexplained videos of all time, in my opinion. And listeners, you'll be able to click through to it on the Dreamland show page. So you can take a look at it while we're discussing this and reflect on the fact that what we're talking about, we'll be talking about, and this is in about half an hour, actually walked down a woodland, through a woodland in near Pittsburgh some years ago and was picked up by a trail cam. So I guess that probably piques everybody's interest a little bit. But before we go there, I must admit that there were a lot of stories in here that gave me pause. In fact, really pretty much all of them did. And these are the kind of stories where you sit around with your kids, maybe your older kids, not the little ones, but the older kids, and you read these stories to each other, and then you say to them, and now, in return for my reading the stories, you can't wake me up in the night. So, okay. An old motel sat like a row of army barracks on the side of a grassy hill in California, about halfway between Bakersfield and Barstow, whereupon something happened to one of the guests, or perhaps I should call her inmates of the motel, Peggy from Texas. Can you tell us her story?
Yes. This one was just absolutely bizarre. And every time I reread that paragraph about Barstow, the only thing that pops into my head is the first paragraph of Hunter S. Thompson's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, because this is the same area that he was traveling through. But anyway, Peggy was traveling to California, and it was late one night, and she pulled over at a motel and got a room, and she was laying in bed watching VH1, and there was a knock on the door, and she got up and went to the door, and the voice at the door asked if she needed towels, and she opened the door as much as the chain would let her, and saw something that probably would have made me faint at that moment. It was a human-sized cockroach standing up on its hind legs, looking at her through the crack in the door, and she screamed. And it was one of the things that she specifically said about looking at it was that it was cleaning its front legs, right around its mouth, like bugs do. And she was, you know, of course, terrified and wanted, just wanted to get out of there as fast as possible. She didn't know what to do, though. Eventually, what she did is threw open the door and kicked one of the legs out from under it, and it fell over. And she was able to start running down the hallway, wherein she saw one of the room people who cleaned up the rooms, and this person was laying unconscious. She didn't pause because the cockroach was squealing behind her, and it was getting closer. And she ran, and she got to the door to the outside. And when she threw it shut, the cockroach was close enough that one of its antennae was sticking out of the door, and the slam broke it off. And she started running, and the roach got outside. But there was a police officer outside, so she felt safer with the police officer and saw this thing running up a hill to disappear into the night. But the thing that really bothered her more than just one cockroach is that there were multiple roaches on top of the hill that it joined and disappeared into the darkness. So, you know, she feels they're out there, breeding, and she's afraid that they're going to take us over at one point.
Well, you know, she shut a door on it, one of its antennae, and she describes it as never having heard a screaming anything, such a loud, high-pitched scream come out of living matter as I did. You wouldn't believe how loud these giant, upright, walking cockroaches could shriek. Now, is there any reason to believe her at all? I mean, let's face it. You and I have not been oppressed by giant cockroaches. I mean, I will admit that at some points when I lived in New York, there was a certain amount of fairly large cockroaches, but not six-footers, let's face it.
Right. The largest cockroach I've ever seen is the Madagascar hissing cockroach. I got to hold one at a zoo, and it was, maybe 2 to 3 inches long. It's about as big as I want them to get. This, along with a number of stories in the book, are stories, and whether they be true or not is up to what the reader thinks. Some of these I don't think are true, but they're just fun stories, and this is one of them. But there are stranger things in this world. There was a species of penguin, 6 foot tall penguin, that was discovered that had lived millennia ago in Antarctica. And H.P. Lovecraft, in his book At the Mountains of Madness, described this exact penguin. So Who knows what existed and might still exist.
Well, I can tell a story about Madagascar hissing cockroaches that I've, as far as I know, is true. Some friends of mine were traveling I've forgotten where they were, on a plane with their teenage son, when suddenly an enormous roach appeared on the back of the seat in front of them and flew off hissing, causing quite a stir in the airplane, and then there were more roaches appearing. It turned out that he had bought Madagascar hissing cockroaches from some pet store or something where they were, and had them in his backpack, and they got out in the plane. And I said to him, "My God, did you guys get arrested?" He said, "Oh no, they were not able to tell where the hissing cockroaches had come from." And we said to our son, "If you say one word, you're dead."
Oh my goodness.
Think about that. That apparently really happened.
Yeah,
I wonder what the lady was up to. I mean, you know, the thing about this that sort of makes me turn around is, why would anyone come up with a story like that if it hadn't happened? You know, people don't have big imaginations. They don't. Well, maybe they do. I mean, who knows? Maybe she had a bad LSD trip or something.
I don't know. Or maybe she ran into 6-foot-tall intelligent cockroaches.
Well, yeah.
Again,
exactly.
The more I've dug into the monsters and the paranormal in general, there's so many bizarre things that happen to people that they're convinced it happened.
Well, wait a minute, we're got to take a break. After we take this break, we're going to talk about a real monster that definitely did happen, according to the National Geographic, which studied it carefully. It's a pretty creepy story. We'll be right back.
UnknownCountry.com. Daily news you can't get elsewhere. A powerful search engine that can open your mind to a world of wonderful news stories dating back 15 years. An insight section like no other. Whitley Strieber's legendary Dreamland. Jeremy Vaney's thoughtful, provocative The Experience. A weekly newsletter, and all for free.
You've probably heard the music for years. It's the theme song for Dreamland. But you may not know the name of the piece, The O of Pleasure. Or the name of the composer, Ray Lynch. Ray Lynch is a 3-time Billboard Award winner. Ray is also the composer of the platinum album, Deep Breakfast. Pandora calls Ray one of the most influential artists in New Age pop and adult alternative circles. For music that will move your heart and set your spirit soaring, visit www.raylynch.com.
We're talking to Jason Offutt, his book, Chasing American Monsters. It's lots of fun, lots of fascination. You have a lot of fun with it. I'm certainly enjoying it a lot. His website is Jason Offutt, OFFUTT.com. That's JasonOffutt.com. Jason, of course, I was referring to Hogzilla, which probably a few people on the show listening have heard about, but you got into Hogzilla a little bit. Could you tell us about Hogzilla?
Right. Well, first, a lot of people who weren't raised around pigs don't really understand how absolutely violent, and they're intelligent too, which is really scary. But they're violent, and I grew up on a farm and we raised pigs, and there are a number of cases each year in North America where farmers get eaten by their pigs. And in the South, there's a feral hog problem. And when these things get years and years and unlimited food and unlimited growth, they get to be enormous, and they're great pests. And in 2004 in Georgia, a man shot one. He claimed that it was 1,000 pounds. I think it was only only about 800
800 pounds.
But an 800-pound boar is a massive creature just wandering around in the woods. And, you know, if somebody runs into one of those who's not armed like this man, they wouldn't come out.
No.
They wouldn't come out of the woods.
No, absolutely not. And even if you were armed, you'd have to take a pretty good shot because maybe it was slow, but the Russian boar and so forth that I've and javelinas I've encountered in my life were damn fast. Although I have to tell you, much smaller, not even close. I mean, they were much smaller. When I read that, I thought to myself, how could anything that big, a hog that big, exist? Because even the biggest porkers are, you know, 400 or 500 pounds. Those are bred for that size. So
right, yeah, the largest we had on the farm was a 450-pound Duroc boar, and it was enormous. And that's about half the size of Hogzilla.
And Hogzilla, the amazing thing is that Hogzilla was found in the wild.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if there's a scientific correlation to this, but when you have fish and you're keeping them in a small place, they stay small. But you take them and put them in a lake, and they grow enormous. Well, it was the opposite way with the woolly mammoths on Wrangell Island that became small mammoths. Because
right.
They didn't have enough room to roam.
Yeah, and they are extinct, by the way, folks, just so we keep our ducks in a row here. But go ahead.
That we know of. The Wrangell Island, of course, the mammoths are extinct. But with Hogzilla out in the wild with nothing to cage him in, and he can eat, and pigs are, they will eat anything. It could grow bigger than that, frankly.
Now, I don't know if you have this in the book about the giant alligator spotted in Florida in 2017.
No, I did no. not. Did not get that one.
Okay. Well, this is another bizarre example of giantism. And folks, you just Google giant alligator Florida and you'll find it. There was a huge, I mean, enormous alligator found in Florida that I would have considered deeply concerning. You know, it's of course ends up on a golf course, as everything awful seems to. I don't know what it is about golf courses and monsters, but they do seem to go together. In any case, this thing is gigantic, and I'm wondering, you know, there was a time on planet Earth when giantism was something that was everywhere. Dinosaurs were huge, and then later in the early Pleistocene, the early part of the Ice Age, we went through another period of giantism where there were huge, there were mammoths and mastodons, of course, and giant ground sloths here in North America and so forth. Could giantism be coming back, do you think?
Well, it's anything, as I'd said before, anything and everything is possible. And yes, I think gigantism could be. Or there might be cases to where it didn't leave. There are a number of cases in the book and other cases I've found since when I've been researching monsters in Canada Pleistocene and Pliocene era dogs and hyenas and rhinoceroses that have been allegedly spotted in Canada running around. So it might still be there in some untouched places in this world. And it's one of the other things that people, you know, when it comes to monsters, don't really get is that, you know, if Bigfoot's real, we would have seen him because people live everywhere in this country. And no, they don't. There are still great swaths of forest and desert that we never look in. So there could be lots of unknown creatures out there that, you know, living next to us that we'll never find.
Exactly. And listen, when we get to the gnome, you will discover that we have glimpsed one. And so they are definitely definitely out there. Now I want to talk about another one that might be a real thing too, for a particularly small but telling reason that you mention in the story about it. But before we do that, Free Dreamlanders, what I want you to do is to listen to very carefully to these suggestions, especially the one about buying my book, In Hitler's House, which is so cool. And hardly anybody who listens to this show will buy it. Yeah, it's a historical novel, but it's about World War II, and it's more fun than most anything you ever read about World War II. And I know I have listeners who think World War II historical novels are cool, and this one is very cool. Okay, we'll be right back.
Whitley Strieber, one of the great authors of our time. War Day changed the way we think about nuclear war. Communion led millions to realize that they had encountered the visitors. Superstorm gave a word to the world that has become the byword of our time. The Key is among the most prophetic books ever written. And where can you get inside the mind that created all this? On UnknownCountry.com, where Whitley's life stories, his powerful meditations, his books Communion, Transformation, The Secret School, and others are available in audio format, and so much more exclusive Whitley Strieber material. Join Whitley on the path to tomorrow. How? Subscribe to UnknownCountry.com today.
This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're talking to Jason Offutt, his new book, Chasing American Monsters. His website, jasonoffutt.com. You can get this book there. You can also get his other two books, which are both very, very cool, about the dark side and one about shadow people, which was extremely popular on this show when we talked about it in 2009, in the dear old days of when Coast to Coast was still rolling with art anyway. I think it was. What I want to talk about this time is the Lovelock skull. Now, can you tell us a little bit about the Lovelock skull?
Well, this was Lovelock Cave in Nevada. A lot of strange things have been found in Nevada, but this in 1967, this skull was found, and people thought it was a Neanderthal skull. It had a protruding brow ridge. The forehead was sloped. The occipital bun was large, which modern humans have these traits, although not, you know, as pronounced as this skull. It looked more like a Neanderthal. But it was also, similar to it was big. It was similar to legends of the local Indians about red haired giants that lived in the area that they fought with, and that's what they figured it probably was. But it's not the only skull that resembled a Neanderthal skull. There were similar ones found in Nebraska much earlier than 1967, but these are just some of many, many skulls found in the United States that don't fit the accepted out of Africa, making their way across the land bridge theory.
Now, you know what's fascinating to me about this, and the reason I said I think it might be a true story, is the red hair. Neanderthals had red hair, and when the Lovelock skull was found, nobody could have known that, and certainly the Paiute didn't know it. But they said that these beings who used to eat them had red hair. And I was really very surprised by that, because none of these people could have known that. Neanderthals weren't supposed to be roaming in the United States and in the North American continent at any time, let alone at a time when the Paiute were here. But of course, the funny thing about these stories and legends is that they go back far, and sometimes we can't tell how far back they go. There was one, though, that was found on the island of, I believe, Formosa, which was a story about an exploding star in the sky. And some scientists and anthropologists who examined this, looked into this legend, determined that there would have been an exploding star, a supernova visible from Formosa about 40,000 years ago. And that story had lasted among this small tribe in central Formosa for all of that time. Extraordinary. So the story could go back for thousands of years.
Well, right, and there are lots of stories that go back that far. The Aborigines in Australia have supposedly been on that continent for that long. That is a long time, and they have a lot of stories that go back to when they first arrived on its shores. So there is a great frustration with me that science and historians don't take the native legends seriously. They take them as myth when, like that, like, well, the Dogon tribe, the knowledge of astronomy that they can't see without powerful telescopes, that they've had for thousands and thousands of years, that these things are dismissed. And I don't see how science, if they're doing their job, can dismiss these things.
Well, they dismiss it because they're actually not doing their job is the problem. The reality is that we generally do not make things up out of whole cloth. Folklore isn't things that are made up. It's things that were seen and observed and which people are trying to explain to themselves. And that's where folklore really comes from. And you can find lots of anthropology papers about that process and how it works. But what you can't find are papers that will take things like the fairy folk and the elves or the gnomes that we're going to be talking about soon and say that, well, there's something being seen there. This is why people will make up these stories, because they see something and they try to explain it.
Right, which is what we've got. Bigfoot legends on every continent except for Antarctica, of course. We've got legends of ghosts in every civilization across the world. And every civilization across the world also had legends of dragons.
Yeah, exactly.
They didn't make these things up. They're so similar that if science is right about we weren't connected until, so many thousands of years ago, where did these stories come from if they didn't see something and it was the same thing that the people on the other side of the world were seeing?
Well, exactly. Exactly. They see something. They may not be right about what it is. They draw conclusions that might not be correct, but you've got some fascinating dinosaur sightings in here. Quite a few of them, actually. Can you tell us a little few dinosaur stories?
Well, I think my favorite ones, at least within the United States, are the pterodactyls stories, because there have been so many of them in Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma. And also a few states north of that. Hawaii also has had sightings, and people describe exactly what I said, a pterodactyl. One of the sightings was in 1977. Three teachers were driving home from a conference in Texas, and they saw a shadow that was outside the car. So they pulled over and looked outside the car, and a pterodactyl with a 20-foot, what they estimated was a 20-foot wingspan, had flown over the car and then flew out of sight in the distance. I think teachers would probably know what a pterodactyl looks like.
And
these things are other places, if I may step outside the United States, in Mexico, South America, New Guinea, there are legends of these. In Africa, I talked with a professor from the University of Missouri a number of years ago. I can't think of his name, but he travels to Africa, and this one tribe talks of the Kogamatu, and they've described it to him. And one of the times he went to visit, he brought a book with a picture of a pterodactyl, and they're like, that is the Kogamatu. So they've seen this in modern days. So the birds survived, alligators and crocodiles and turtles, small mammals, they all survived the extinction from 65 million years ago. Why couldn't some dinosaurs have done it as well?
Yeah, I mean, at least some of them, you just don't know. And, I mean, after all, a lot of people think that the Loch Ness Monster is a plesiosaur. And, you know, there's a small breeding colony of plesiosaurs in Loch Ness, and we don't know how they behaved, what they're like, what their senses are like, anything much about them at all, except we do have a lot of bones, or not in the cases of plesiosaurs, many, but some bones. And we just don't know. We don't even know enough about how time works in this world. Anne and I have had time slips. We know they're real. We've experienced them, and you can find, if you go to Unknown Country, folks, and look up time slips or Starfire Tour, you'll find our time slip stories, which are exhaustively researched and witnessed by other people. So stuff happens. It happens.
Right, and the things that we don't know, this one, when I did reading on this, kind of blew my mind, is that we really don't know how gravity works.
Yeah, tell us. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, it's just that it doesn't work the same. Where does gravity come from? You know, there is scientific speculation, but 100% sure they don't know how gravity works. It's different in some places than it is in others.
Well, we have gravity maps of this planet that show that gravity is variable on Earth too.
Right, and giving the explanation about the, you know, the molten Earth core and how the spinning is supposed to make gravity work. If that is true, we should have constant gravity everywhere, and we definitely don't.
We do not, no. Let's go on to another story, which is related to the pterodactyl story. And this is one I particularly wanted to talk about, because in this case, it's something I have seen. I was walking my son to school, or home from school, one afternoon, and when we lived in Greenwich Village, we happened to look up, and there, flying above Lower Manhattan, was an enormous bird. And it had to have been huge, because it was very high, but it was absolutely huge, big. Now, I came across the story of thunderbirds in the book, and the Terra Torrent. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. Thunderbirds were Native American legends. Again, I'm saying legends, but Native American stories about these gigantic birds that they're called thunderbirds because when their wings flapped, they made the sound of thunder. They're also supposedly caused lightning. But these were real birds, teratorns, that lived between the Miocene and Pleistocene eras. Teratorn is Greek. That means monster bird. They had wingspans of 11 to 20 feet, and could, you know, the weight could be as the same as a grown man, about 180 pounds. And it was like enormous condors. And people have seen them in recent times. They've seen them in Pennsylvania and Maine and California throughout the country. A man flying a small plane in Alaska a number of years, I think probably 20 years ago.
In 2002.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, October of 2002.
Reported seeing one of these flying outside of his plane. And I tend to trust people like pilots and police officers and you know, the military. These people are trained to observe. And I think he would know the size of the bird that he saw outside of his plane. And it was the size of his plane. Again,
yeah.
Like the pterodactyls, I mean, why couldn't pterotorns have survived for the last 10,000 years, you know, hidden away someplace where man doesn't venture?
You know, at this point, I want to bring up another theory. And this theory comes from the NIDS ranch, the National Institute for Discovery Sciences ranch that Bob Bigelow bought years ago because of the fact that so much paranormal activity was happening there. He decided, being a billionaire, to buy the ranch and install a team of scientists on it. And Colm Kelleher, who was working on this project, wrote a book about it. I interviewed him here on Dreamland, and subscribers, if you look up Colm, C-O-L-M, that's all you really need to put in, you would find the interview. In any case, he reported that at the beginning, when they were just transitioning, the scientists were literally on their way to the ranch. The family was waiting for them to come, that owned the ranch, and they were sitting outside, and there was a paddock with a goat in it, and there are some goats in it. And suddenly, a gigantic wolf, huge, 300-pounder, they found out exactly how much it weighed later on, came walking up out of a wetland and jumped the fence and into the paddock and started going after the goats. The rancher, or I believe his son, started firing a rifle at it, and it didn't affect it until finally it became seemingly annoyed by the bullets, jumped back over the paddock fence and went back into the wetland and disappeared. A short time later, the scientists arrived, and immediately the family, of course, was full of this story, and they went down to the wetland to investigate, where they found footprints that they made casts of, and they figured out that this wolf had weighed in at about 300 pounds. Now, this wolf disappeared. It literally, its foot tracks disappear in the middle of the wetland. I think it's possible that we were talking about time slips earlier, that every once in a while there is a kind of slip maybe between this world and another version of it that's right here, right now, where the Pleistocene hasn't ended and the planet has not been populated with billions of human beings. And that's where these creatures come from. And maybe they have evolved a defense mechanism which enables them to go back and forth between the worlds. Just an idea.
Well, and John Keel wrote about this. He said that the places where high strangeness happened were window areas, and where this sort of stuff could happen. And it sure would explain a lot of times when there are Bigfoot encounters, and the Bigfoot just seems to have stepped into nothing and just disappeared. It could fit the same with spacecraft that tends to disappear. Where did it go? I mean, it could be through one of these thin areas. And yeah, you're right. They develop something that they can just skip over. That would explain a lot.
Yeah, it would explain a lot, and maybe they have evolved an ability, a defense mechanism to do that, or to slip through time somehow. We don't see, our science doesn't see how slipping through time would be possible, but slipping from one parallel universe to another might very well be possible. In fact, it might even be, for example, NASA has discovered that building a wormhole between parallel universes is much more possible than building a wormhole between two places in this universe. So maybe some of these creatures haven't built wormholes. Maybe they just have evolved this as a kind of defense mechanism.
That would be really handy in uncomfortable social situations.
Also, if you're going to get eaten by something, well.
Yeah, that too.
Now we're going to shift now into the world of beings and gnomes and UFOs in particular. I want to start out with one of the most interesting stories in here, which you call Gargantuan Gliders.
Okay, and this is a one of a kind type encounter. This was in the mid 1920s.
1925, it says.
Okay, 1925. Yeah, a pilot named Don Wood Jr. Landed on top of a butte, or on a mesa, And he was, he saw something on top of there. He had a companion with him, and they saw something about 8 feet wide, and it was trying to land, and they couldn't explain what it was. It was round, and it was flat, and it was alive. It didn't look like, you know, anything they could explain. Its belly was red, and it was hurt. And it eventually landed, and it was breathing. It was struggling with breathing. And they said that where it was breathing, a half-foot hole would open up on the. It was like a clam was opening and closing. That's how it was breathing. And eventually, another one of these came over them, and it was much larger. It was about 30 feet wide, and picked up the smaller one and flew away with it at a really, really fast speed. What on earth could that have been? I only had one other similar type story. A man in California, this would have been I think he said it was in the 80s. I don't have it in the book, I don't think. Was surf fishing and saw something that was sort of similar to this. It wasn't round, though. It was more rectangular, and he could see its eyes, and it was just flying through the air, and it flew over him and disappeared, but it was translucent. Just bizarre stories.
You know, Ed Conroy, who wrote the book Report on Communion, had a very strange experience once in San Antonio, on a street in San Antonio called New Braunfels Avenue. He was riding along, I believe, with one of his daughters, and a white something suddenly flew through the car and lickety-split right in front of their eyes and through the closed windows. Now, here's the odd part. At about the same time, we didn't compare notes until many years later, and just then by accident, Ann and I had exactly the same experience in approximately the same place on that road. And you have to wonder if there might not be a whole lot of creatures that live in the air that move so quickly that we don't generally see them. And maybe that creature the man saw on the mesa was hurt and therefore had slowed down. Maybe there's a whole world out there that's perfectly normal, part of nature, nothing particularly paranormal about it that we just don't see.
That is fascinating. I read, I think it was Ambrose Bierce, a short story that he'd written about a pilot in the early days of flying, and had went too far up in the air and went into a world that existed only in above the clouds, that was filled with all these fantastic flying creatures. That is bizarre that just came up, because I just read that story fairly recently. There could be. I mean, of course, science says that there are things living in living up, you know, all sorts of, you know, bacteria and life living just floating up in the air. So, I mean, maybe something big lives there.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I've read that story too. And as I was telling the story just now, I was thinking, gosh, I wish I could remember the name of that story. I don't know whether it was by Ambrose Bierce or not either, but the story exists. And I remember when I read it, I thought, maybe this is true. Maybe there is something to it. Because I don't want to get into it now, but I've got some hyper strange UFO stories that would suggest maybe that it is true, but we're getting a little far afield at that point. We can talk about that another time, folks. Now, what I would like to do now is to get into the story of the gnome. And after we're finished, I will tell you why. Why don't you tell us the story of the gnome?
Okay, the gnomes, I'm going to preface this by saying, there are so many little people stories around the world that are so similar to each other that really, really, really make me believe that there is definitely something to it. Now, This particular gnome story was in California near the town of Porterville. I spoke with a woman named Tammy, who she and her children rented a house near a river outside of Porterville, California. It had a barn. There was a shed that she didn't like to go by because she felt creepy, or it felt creepy, and the animals, her dogs, and she had some chickens and ducks, didn't go around that shed either. Things started disappearing. Some of her pets, some of the and the chickens and the ducks started disappearing as well. And she thought, you know, maybe coyotes or raccoons or something were getting to them. Until one day, when she and her son pulled in to the house, they'd gone to the grocery store, and she had the hatch to the station wagon open, and she was, you know, grabbed a bag of groceries and heard a chuckle, an evil chuckle, and, you know, it made her blood run cold. And she turned around and looked, and standing, casually leaning against the creepy shed was a man about between 2 feet, 3 feet tall, had a golden shirt, a golden tunic, a dirty beard that came down in a point. It had black eyes and sharp pointed teeth. And the thing was wearing a conical red hat. It was a stereotypical gnome. Well, she dropped the groceries, grabbed her son, ran into the house, slammed the door. And her daughters were curious, "Mom, what's going on?" And she told them to duck. And then that pointed hat came to the window of the kitchen and went to another window of the kitchen. And it really was freaking her out even more because the gnome was about, you know, less than 3 feet tall, but the windows were 10 feet off the ground. Eventually the thing went away and she heard the laugh a lot. And eventually got scared and finally and took her family and moved out of that house. And that story by itself is pretty freaky, but I also talked to another person who read that story. Her name was Charlie. Her and her husband had been in the military, and they had rented a house outside of Porterville, California, near the river. And it also had a barn and a shed on the property that gave her and her husband the creeps. And they also noticed that their dogs, they had a couple of dogs that wouldn't go near the shed. And well, they ignored that. They put a koi pond outside, and they noticed that their fish kept disappearing. And eventually they decided to take the rest of the fish and put them in an aquarium inside the house. And the night they did that, they heard a scream. Charlie heard a scream at about 2 o'clock in the morning and looked out the window. They had put a light outside, you know, to scare off any animals that were eating their fish. And she saw this little man with a gold tunic, pointed dirty beard, and a red conical hat staring at her. And she couldn't understand the language, but she said it sounded like it was cussing. And they called the police. They didn't say there was a gnome outside, but the police came. Well, of course you're not. But the police came and found footprints of what they said looked like a 12-year-old had been walking barefoot around their koi pond. A few other smaller things happened, but they decided, you know, we got to get out of here. One of the thing that really clinched it is this thing was outside the house. They could hear it running around shrieking. And then they realized, oh my gosh, the doggy door is not locked. And the husband ran into the kitchen and did a baseball slide across the kitchen floor and kicked the dog door that was starting to open inward. And there had been something on the other side. He latched a lock on it, and they left soon after.
Yeah, I can certainly understand that.
Well, I can understand. I wouldn't have stayed there that long. I got these two women together, Tammy and Charlie, because the story sounded too similar. And they got together and went to the house. And it was, they'd lived in the same house and had the same experiences at different times.
And now, folks, if you look on the Dreamland show page, you will find an image of just such a being. It was taken in a woods by a trail cam outside of Pittsburgh some years ago, sent to Linda Moulton Howe, and she has given me permission to use it pretty much as I wish. It's a gnome, just like Jason just described, right down to the peaked hat. They're real. They're real. It's as simple as that. We have analyzed this. The being, the creature, is moving at about 1,200 feet a minute, a very fast motion, in other words. You see it very brief. It might be 1,200 feet a second. Frankly, I forget. But it's so fast that you only see two shots of it on the trail cam, two frames of the trail cam, which is moving at 24 frames per second, or 18 frames per second, I think, show this. And there was a man, you don't see it in the image, but there was a man standing just outside of the frame who is obviously not seeing it at all. And yet it moved right past him down this path. So they're there. And, you know, Jason, in kind of at the, we're coming to the end of the show. I would like you to tell me if there's any one particular type of creature that stands out in your mind. I mean, not the gnomes, obviously, but others that you think might be real that are really out there in numbers. Bigfoot, maybe, or something like that.
Well, that's the one I was going to bring up, is that I think there are probably a number of creatures in my book that exist that we will find.
Hogzilla exists. We know that.
I'm sorry. What?
Hogzilla exists.
Right. Hogzilla exists. Yes, we definitely know that. Bigfoot. Again, as I said earlier, it's been, you know, it's not just a North American thing. You know, the Canadians and the people in the Pacific Northwest don't have a claim on Bigfoot. It's seen in every state in the Union except Hawaii. There have been stories of Bigfoot-like creatures a bit smaller in South America. Africa, there were stories for decades and decades that Westerners didn't believe, of enormous chimpanzees that walked on their back legs, howled at the moon, and killed lions. And in 1998, the Billy Ape, B-I-L-I ape, was discovered. And you know what? That's exactly what it did. And it also behaved a lot like a gorilla. It built, it builds nests and has, chimpanzee and gorilla characteristics. Australia has the Yowie. We've got the Yeren in China. We've got the Orang Pindag. We've got the Alma. So if anything exists in this book, I'm betting on Bigfoot.
Yeah, I think so too. I think there are other humanoid creatures that exist, species that exist besides us, and some of them maybe have evolved that ability to move back and forth between parallel universes that we were talking about earlier, which would explain why Bigfoot can't be found. Why, or either that, or they have the ability to read minds, because Bigfoot is so elusive, and yet there's so much evidence of its existence that it has to have some additional ability to elude detection that is above and beyond the usual. It has to.
Right, and there's also something that people don't take into consideration, or maybe they haven't spent a lot of times in the woods, but going up around big wooded areas, there were many times I was walking around the woods, and I was within a couple of feet of a grown deer, and I wouldn't have known it was there if it hadn't have jumped out from behind a bush and ran off. So, I mean, Bigfoot is probably really adept at blending in with the environment. I think that might be one of the reasons they seem to disappear into the woods.
Well, quite possibly, because whatever they do, they are very good at it. But the other thing is, we've not found ever any evidence like a dead body or spore or anything like that. Maybe some spore, but it's very equivocal. My parents knew Tom Slick, who was the first person to organize a scientific expedition to find the Yeti in Tibet, the abominable snowman, and he didn't succeed. But he died tragically, in fact, in an airplane crash, thinking that he was on to something real. So, you know, and I think there is something out there. Jason Offutt, Chasing American Monsters. Very cool. Jason's website, JasonOffutt with 2Ts.com. Thanks for being with us. What have you got on your plate, Jason, if I may ask?
Well, I'm working. I mentioned Canada. I'm working on Chasing Canada's Monsters. Just got finished with a novel that is undergoing the editing process right now.
Well, good luck with that, and thank you so much for being with us on one of the oldest podcasts on the internet and one of the most popular. And thank you all so much for listening every week the way you do. I'm so grateful to you. This is Dreamland, and this is Whitley Strieber. Thank you all for listening.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.